God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 20-784, Robert L. Ford, appellate to the District of Columbia. The findings of the appellate, Mr. McKay, and the applicant.
Good morning. If it please the court, I'm Matthew LaFondi. I am the attorney for Robert Ord, the plaintiff in this case. In 2004, the Virginia Assembly substantially revamped and reinvigorated the Office of the Special Conservator of the Peace, in part to address what is I would describe as an inherent conflict in the employment of municipal officers as moonlighting police for private entities. This essentially is a state-enforced monopoly on the provision of public policing services and the delegation of those services as the municipality sees fit and not necessarily meeting the needs of the specialized requirements of industry. In expanding and regulating the Office of the Special Conservator of Peace, it permitted entities to employ public officers as they found necessary for the security of property or maintaining the public peace. Even while employed as a private entity, the conservator remains a public officer acting on behalf of the sovereign. The broad law enforcement authority of a conservator of the peace necessarily brings them within the definition of a duly appointed or qualified law enforcement officer for the purpose of the exemptions under District of Columbia or federal law. Sometime around 2005, certain individuals within the Metropolitan Police Department, police reserve officers, were appointed under Virginia Code 19213, and questions arose regarding their exemptions under District of Columbia law. Certain members within the Metropolitan Police Department vigorously opposed any expansion of the volunteers' authority beyond the limitations set forth by the department. This opposition materialized most vividly within the memorandum written by Inspector Victor Brito.
Has that been withdrawn?
No, it has not been.
So that memorandum is still the governing policy?
I have never seen anything to the contrary. Certainly.
So when your case was nalprost, it was just your case?
Just that case, that's right. And as I pointed out to the court and in the original appeal, we asserted that was done solely to deprive us of the opportunity to have that issue litigated and decided whether he actually had that exemption. As was referenced in the original Ord opinion at page 9, referencing the appellee's brief at page 24, the District of Columbia continues to affirm their intention to prosecute special conservators of the peace for weapons violations in the district. And as I've asked the court to take judicial notice of the James Thorne case, the special conservator of the peace was recently arrested, indicted, and is presently being prosecuted in Superior Court for carrying a pistol without a license, unregistered firearm, and unregistered ammunition. Where there was no contrary to the appellee's unfounded allegations in their opposition to the judicial notice or the opposition to the docketing of the supplemental appendix, there was no nefarious activity. He simply had presented himself to police in an assistance of an investigation of the gunshots that had been fired and identified himself as a police officer, at which time he was questioned as whether he had a firearm on him, which he answered in the affirmative, and was subsequently arrested, with the Metropolitan Police officers coming to the erroneous conclusion, as they stated in their affidavit before the Superior Court, that Thorne was a security guard and not a law enforcement officer. The original decision, recognized that Ord's ability to travel and carry on his business was restricted by this threat of prosecution.
Yeah, but the issue the first time around was different. That was a question of standing.
Yes.
And our standard review here, your obligation here is very different. In the first case, the court had to accept your allegations. We had to accept them as true. Here, you're appealing the denial of a preliminary injunction, and you have to show irreparable injury. We don't just assume it. So our earlier decision doesn't help you on the irreparable injury, right?
It doesn't help me with irreparable injury, but it discussed what the nature of the injury was and recognized
that.
But
you still have to establish the injury, and, you know, the district court here found you hadn't, And I didn't see anything in your brief suggesting that that was wrong. The district court thought your affidavit was essentially, out of date. It didn't describe the current condition of Ord's business.
Ord's business has not changed. The affidavit is.
You understand what I'm.
I understand what you're saying.
The district court said that the data was stale, that it didn't describe the current. And then he went on to say, and even if it did, that $2 million in revenues were sufficient to at least conclude that this wouldn't jeopardize his business.
And the issue
what's the answer to that?
The answer to that is that the data is not stale, that he has continues to refrain from that business, as we plainly stated.
But you see, you've got a finding by the district court here that we're reviewing.
Well, we
the district court has
that
found
finding,
that it's stale.
The Ord has plainly stated he will not go into the District of Columbia. He will not continue his business. He's entered exhibits. He has made
and
an
the district
affidavit.
Court and the district that was the argument you made in the district court, and the district court found that that was insufficient for irreparable injury.
Well, the irreparable injury, which I assert in part, is that what was not necessarily a Fourth Amendment deprivation, but what was recognized in the Ord decision as a First Amendment deprivation, which in his inability to travel. And that was...
Well, he can travel into the district. He just has to leave his gun in Virginia.
The inability of his gun to travel.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
He can travel.
The inability of his gun to travel, not...
Right. Well, yeah, and that was the issue. And in fact,
right,
in this case...
No, the constitutional right... Sorry.
Go on, please.
Constitutional right to travel isn't to travel with a weapon.
No, there isn't.
So he can leave his gun at home and travel to the district.
Well, that was the problem, is that he had a difficulty with that, in that he's performing...
It's a difficulty, engaged. But it's not a right to travel claim.
Well,
I
disagree with that, in that there's he has to carry his gun in the performance of his duties in Virginia, and he's trying to conduct business in the District of Columbia. We have asserted that he has no...
Well, that's more like a Commerce Clause claim.
Well, that isn't part of Commerce Clause claim. It is interfering with the interstate commerce.
You make that argument in your brief?
No, I have not raised that in the brief.
It's not in your complaint. Speaking of that, let me ask you about your argument about likely success on the merit, right? You have to show that, too.
Right.
So I read your brief, and you go on for quite a few pages about why Ord is a qualified law enforcement officer for purposes of the federal statute, right?
Yes.
And a state law enforcement officer for purposes of the D.C. exemption, right?
That's correct.
But I didn't see any discussion of your various causes of action, like your Fourth Amendment claim.
Ah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
The Fourth Amendment claim, which we... Yeah, that is discussed in there, and there was in a complete absence of the probable cause in the original warrant, in that he was never even alleged to have been present in the District of Columbia. The District of Columbia and its overzealousness to prosecute these.
But where would I find in your brief an argument, other than the statutory argument you make, an argument that this rises to a Fourth Amendment problem?
Well,
I just didn't.
It's an arrest. It's an.
No. Where in the brief do you argue that?
Okay. I've argued throughout the brief that there's an exemption, that he's entitled to an exemption. If there's an exemption, then there's no probable cause for him to be arrested.
But for him to succeed on that, you have to show that the statutes are so unambiguous, you know, that a reasonable officer couldn't believe that he was violating.
Oh, we absolutely assert that. I mean,
there's
a plain statement by the Virginia Circuit Court.
I was asking you where you made that argument in your brief.
As to the ambiguousness of it?
Yeah, the unambiguousness of it.
I think that the brief that's throughout the brief is that his status is unambiguous, mm-hmm. that he has the right to this exemption, and that's been stated repeatedly, that the Metropolitan Police Department has been repeatedly informed of this. And they persist in this prosecution. So in that regard, I think that's well stated within the brief. Uh-huh. I see my time is up here.
I will give you a couple minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Mufendi. Okay.
May it please the Court, I'm James McKay, and I represent the District of Columbia. The District Court did not abuse its discretion in denying Robert Ord's motion for a preliminary injunction. Mr. Ord has not demonstrated he would likely suffer irreparable harm absent the preliminary injunction, and this alone is, as the District Court pointed out, is fatal to his motion for a preliminary injunction. He made two arguments below when he sought to renew his motion for preliminary injunction: the economic harm to Falcon Industries, his company, and the jeopardy to his appointment as a special conservator of the peace and his federal government clearances. The District Court properly found that his evidence of these two potential harms was not only stale but also weak.
Why does he have to update his evidence on this? I mean, it's not as if, presumably he would have an obligation to report a change in that made his affidavit stale.
Well, as the Supreme Court said in the Dombrowski case, equitable relief, injunctive relief looks to the future, and Mr. Ord had an obligation 2 years later to at least give the court the current status of Falcon Industries' business to support his claim of economic harm.
I don't follow that. He didn't. He wasn't asked for that, and he didn't volunteer an update. Correct.
He had the obligation. He had the burden of proving irreparable harm. In any case,
sure he did. But once he put it in the affidavit, at what point did he have an obligation to repeat it?
Well, the District Court also found that his assertion, which has no evidentiary basis, that he lost $100,000 was not significant in view of his sworn statement that his business had $2 million in revenue a year. And this court has held that in order for economic harm to a business to be irreparable harm, it has to threaten the very existence of a business, and the loss of a small 5% of business is not the sort of economic harm that would threaten the very existence of a business. Therefore, the District Court properly held that that was not, did not rise to the level of the sort of economic harm that would constitute irreparable harm.
Does he own this business? I don't remember.
He is the president and, as I understand, the owner of this business, Falcon Industries. He also points to no evidence that the potential arrest would jeopardize his status as a special conservator of the peace. If what he says is correct, he wasn't even in the district and therefore wouldn't any attempt to arrest him.
No, wait a minute, that's circular. He's saying he can't come into the district because of this threat of arrest, and you're saying, well, then there's no harm to him, he's not coming into the district.
No, I wasn't saying that. I was saying that his second allegation of irreparable injury is that his status as a special conservator of the peace, which requires that he be on good conduct, would be jeopardized by the potential of arrest, and I think the District Court very properly concluded that there's no evidence suggested that being prosecuted but ultimately found innocent would jeopardize his status as a special conservator of the peace. Now, in addition, you know, he raises a new argument on appeal the fact that he has a right to travel. As this court said, he doesn't have a right to travel with his gun. And in any case, he has to show an imminence. In order to get a preliminary injunction, the harm he has to show has to be actual and imminent and great, not speculative or hypothetical. He hasn't shown that. He also doesn't, I think the District Court also properly held that he had his arguments on the merits were very weak. The LEOSA, Law Enforcement Officer Safety Act, clearly contemplates that this very extraordinary right given to these police officers is limited to public servants, and that's a language in the Senate report. who are sworn law enforcement officers, had Congress intended this extraordinary right to bring in an unregistered weapon, concealed weapon, across state lines without, despite laws of the contrary, were to extend to the many conservatives, the special police officers, special conservatives of the peace, people who are authorized to carry a gun just for the purpose of protecting the business, if Congress had intended this extraordinary right to apply to those, Congress would have clearly said so. The fact that it had to specially make it clear that the Federal Reserve Board officers were within it shows you that
The Federal Reserve Board.
The OSA has a special. It says you have to be a governmental employee, and it's clear that Mr. Orr doesn't qualify. The district court said, Congress then says, well, the agency has to approve your use of the gun, and talks. It uses the word agency about three or four times, and then it says, just make this very clear: any police officer employed by the federal executive branch, or the Federal Reserve Board, or the Amtrak police, they are included in this. Now, if Congress had intended LEOSA to apply to the persons whose only status derives from their being a special police officer or a special conservator of the peace, I'm sure Congress would have said so, but it didn't. And
does it apply to the state police?
Yes, it would. Highway patrolman, Virginia, it would apply to somebody like that, a sworn officer who is a public servant, and that's what it applies to. And it's very clear. Those are the types of officers that LEOSA applies to. And similarly, the district law, DC Code 725.02.02b1, applies to officers that, you know, in the performance of their official authorized functions. Again, the language of the statute is limited to the traditional sworn police officers. Doesn't apply to the many hundreds of thousands of special police officers or special conservators of the peace throughout the country whose only authority to carry a firearm is to protect a particular property from burglary or whatever. It doesn't apply to them. It's the intent in both statutes is to limit the exemption to carrying an unregistered firearm to traditional sworn police officers who are public servants. The district court also properly found that Mr. Ord had not met the other factors required for a preliminary injunction, the balance of the harms. Clearly, when the government, an important public safety law designed to protect people from firearms, is enjoying that, hurts the public interest, and as the Supreme Court recently said, when the government is a defendant, the public interest and the balance of harms of the same inquiry.
If he's right about the statute, we wouldn't get to the public, and I shouldn't say right. If he has a probability of success on the merits regarding the statute,
that's one of the.
Then I don't see why the balance would favor protecting the public from people who have a right to carry a gun. Because the whole purpose of the statute was to protect the public by allowing such people to carry guns.
Well, Your Honor, it is a separate independent factor from the likelihood of success in the merits. And even putting that aside, as the Supreme Justice Rehnquist said, Chief Justice Rehnquist, when the government's laws are enjoined, the government is harmed. And we're balancing the harms here. We're talking about, of course, a preliminary injunction. This case is proceeding before District Court Judge Bates, and this is an interlocutory appeal from the denial of a preliminary injunction. The District Court did not abuse its discretion in deciding that Mr. Ord was not entitled to this extraordinary equitable relief. I think the district court was correct, and this court should affirm.
Thank you, Mr. McKay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
If I could please turn the court's attention to the appendix, the joint appendix at page 53. This is Ord's oath of office for his appointment with the Fauquier's Circuit Court. As that plainly demonstrates, Ord is, in fact, what the District of Columbia keeps referring to as a sworn officer, unlike an SPO or a security guard. Ord has taken an oath of office to defend the Constitution of both the United States and Virginia and to perform his duties incumbent upon his office as a conservator of the peace. The district refers to, in talking about Leosa, refers to a governmental employee. Ord is not a governmental employee, and that's not what the statute requires. The statute requires that he be an employee of a governmental agency. And agency, we don't refer to the brick and mortar that's funded by Congress. We refer to being standing in the shoes of the sovereign to perform those functions on behalf of the sovereign. Agency of one person to another, agency from the government to an individual. In that regard, as in the Federal Reserve,
so, by your lights, then a government contractor would be a government agent.
You have them in this very building, performing inherently governmental functions as special deputy marshals. Those folks are employees of a private company under contract with the Court Security Division of the United States Marshals, and they are clothed with inherent governmental authority. Nobody's going to say that those people are not government agents, and the people who are performing, the organization that they work for is performing an inherently governmental function by sending them here and protecting you. And in that regard, once...
So really, it's a bit of a stretch in terms of the ordinary use of the term, agent.
Well, no.
I'm a government agent, but I'm really employed by a contractor.
Well, that happens every single day and in numerous instances. And the question becomes, once the organization takes on the inherently governmental function, is it in an agency relationship with the government? And the case law, which I cite in the reply brief, it clearly dictates that is, in fact, the case. And for these reasons, we ask the court to take judicial notice of the James Thorne prosecution as demonstrating imminence, and we ask that the court reverse the decision of the district court and grant Robert Ord's preliminary injunction upon his showing of a likelihood of success on the merits and the constitutional deprivations that would continue to occur should the injunction not be granted.
Thank you, Mr. LaFondi.
Thank you.
McKay, thank you. Case is submitted.